Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, February 19th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Water Cooler. I'm Cherry Gregg.
wasn't ready for that.
Yes.
I'm Avi Wolfner. Yeah, welcome to the Water Cooler. Today at the Water Cooler, we are talking about something called looks maxing, which is an online subculture, mostly young men, who go to great extremes to look as good as possible. Now, I'll be honest, part of the show today is just figuring out what this is and how it came to be. But below that, I think there's a deeper question and a deeper inquiry that we want to get at here. We have talked a lot on this show, and you've heard it elsewhere, about what social media has done to young people's beauty standards and their self-esteem. But typically, that conversation has been through the lens of girls and young women. Well, looks maxing is especially popular among young men. And we want to use this as a jumping off point to look at how social media has changed the way young men view themselves. So we have a couple of questions for you this hour as we get ready to tee up that conversation. Why are young men feeling pressure to look a certain way? And what do you think looks maxing says about our culture? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And I will say, a few weeks ago, I had never heard of looks maxing, but I have a Gen Z living at my home.
Yes.
And I mentioned it to her, and she knew exactly what it was, was very familiar with the culture of it. And so if you've never heard of it, if you have a young person in your life, it's very likely they know all about it. And so now you will too. Again, why are young men feeling the pressure to look a certain way? And what do you think looks maxing says about our culture? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And it's DJ of the day because it's Thursday.
It is indeed Thursday. We always end the show on Thursday with a song picked by one of you on the theme of that day's show. So I don't know, beauty, perfection, online culture, you can go with this one any way
looking
you want.
Looking good, however you want to.
However you want to do it, but you submit your suggestions for a song to EP Kevin. He picks one, and then we shout you out at the end of the show and play the song. Send your suggestions to studio2@whyy.org by 12:30.
So time is ticking.
Time is ticking.
And we have our trio of news stories. We have some breaking news.
Yeah, we're actually going to start with some breaking news. A story that just came on the radar within the last 30 minutes to an hour. So the president's house, just down the street from us, 6 and Market Street, part of Independence Mall. As you likely know, it long featured an exhibit about slavery. The Trump administration removed that exhibit recently, and then the city of Philadelphia sued because there was some contractual language about involving the city in decisions about that exhibit and other exhibits on the Independence Mall. A judge ruled in favor of the city recently, issuing an injunction, and gave the federal government 48 hours until tomorrow to restore the exhibit as the federal government is appealing. Well, what happened within the last hour is that they began to put those panels back up. It's possible by now they're all back up. I'm not entirely positive, but those panels, that exhibit about slavery at the president's house just down the street from us, 6 and Market, is now in the process of being put back up. The appeal, by the way, by the federal government, as far as we know, is still ongoing, and we have no reason to believe what's happening today is in any way a commentary on that. But it is an important evolution in this case that has captured the city's attention.
Yeah. And by the way, I texted, we texted Michael Cord, who's the head of the Avenging the Ancestors Coalition. They have been putting on rallies and they joined the city's lawsuit against the Trump administration on this. He sent us a picture showing National Park Service employees putting it back. It's probably up by now. They had a small crowd there watching this happen, but they're going to have a rally today at 3:30. And I'm assuming like a lot of these supporters are going to be claiming victory when they get there. But like you said, Avi, the appeal continues to go forward. The ruling by the judge was simply in response to their motion for a preliminary injunction. So they wanted to stop the removal and restore it for now until the overall issue
can be worked out.
Yep. So, and this is a unique situation. I think we talked about this. The city had raised the money for this exhibit,
yep,
and they had this unique arrangement with the federal government. So not sure if this case will set a precedent, but for now, it'll be back.
It'll be back. Let's go to story number two, Cherry. We want to dive into this one. Fascinating investigation by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Go ahead.
A members-only bar for Philadelphia police officers has been linked to two DUIs and a DUI-related crash. The Philadelphia Inquirer did this deep dive investigation into 7C Lounge in Northeast Philadelphia. It is a members-only club for active and retired cops operated by the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 5. The lounge is located inside of the union's headquarters. And the thing that people probably remember, back in February of 2021, an off-duty police officer left that bar after having consumed as many as 20 alcoholic beverages, got into his car, and crashed into the home of Raymond and Anna Wakeman, seriously injuring Anna and killing their two dogs. That off-duty officer, Gregory Campbell, was arrested. He was fired from the PPD and was eventually charged and sentenced to 11 to 23 months in prison. Well, that's one thing, but the Inquirer uncovered hidden details about that crash, including the facts that on the night of the incident, Campbell was allowed to confer with representatives of the FOP. He was able to delay a blood alcohol test for nearly 6 hours. And under Pennsylvania law, that test should have been administered within 2 hours. It's unclear why that delay occurred, but when he was tested, his blood alcohol level was 3 times the legal threshold for driving. PPD tried to interview folks at the bar that night, and guess what? The bar had shut down hours earlier, and a manager later testified that he had been following orders. So there's some
inference here of maybe a cover-up. That's really what's coming through in the investigation.
Yeah, and there was a lot of facts. I mean, in addition to this 2021 crash, the Inquirer discovered two additional crashes, one in the 7C Lounge parking lot that was never reported. I mean, this person got into a car, they were stumbling, they mm-hmm. crashed through the fence, hit multiple cars, all sorts of things. There was also another crash back in 2019 where an off-duty officer linked again to this lounge smashed into the Wakeman's SUV.
The same couple.
Yeah.
Had their property crashed into twice by police officers or former police officers who we believe were drinking at this lounge inside police union headquarters.
Yeah. And another fact that sort of stood out to both of us is the fact that this lounge doesn't have any sanctions, despite the fact that there are very stringent requirements for maintaining a liquor license.
You're not supposed to overserve people.
And there's all sorts of questions about conflicts of interest just going on, the off PPD investigating this. And so just lots of questions raised by this investigation from the Inquirer.
And if you're a public servant, whether you're a police officer or any other type of public servant, trust is something you have to keep and maintain. And incidences like this, trust can vanish just like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions unanswered about how these investigations were carried out or why investigations didn't happen.
Yeah, lots of questions here. Very, very much worth a read in the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Yeah. Story number three.
Yeah. So this one was interesting. The grandson of the inventor of Reese's Peanut Butter Cups is big mad at Hershey's. He says they have been cutting corners and hurting the brand with cheap ingredients. 70-year-old Brad Reese is the grandson of H.B. Reese, who invented the peanut butter cups back in 1928. His 6 sons then sold the company to Hershey's in 1963. But Brad is working to protect the Reese's name. He wrote a Valentine's Day letter to the brand manager at Hershey's who deals with Reese's. He accused the company of replacing milk chocolate with compound coatings and peanut butter with peanut cream. Yes, and he posted his letter to Hershey's on his LinkedIn profile, and he took issue with the fact that Hershey's has made the ingredient switcheroo of this flagship brand quietly. That's according to Brad Reese.
The real question is, do you believe him? Have Reese's gotten worse?
Yeah, I mean, I love Reese's Cups.
I love them. And by the way, they're like maybe the most popular single candy in America. There's some...
Oh, yeah.
Like
and
M&M's,
Easter
Reese's
is coming, people. Easter's coming.
I have not noticed any difference.
Yeah.
And I will say Hershey's has been a good steward of this brand for 60 years. I mean, no offense to the guy, but his family hasn't been involved in a long time.
I know, but Hershey has acknowledged some recipe changes, but they said that the peanut butter cups are made the same way they've always have been, with milk chocolate and peanut butter that the company makes itself from roasted peanuts. But you got to admit, cocoa is expensive, and a lot of companies
have been
tinkering.
So there might be an incentive. There might be incentive. Chocolate drama. We got a lot of chocolate history here in Pennsylvania. We got York's, Goldenberg's. We got Whitman's is from Philadelphia.
I know, man. And people don't play about those Reese's Cups.
We are a center of chocolate and chocolate drama. That's what you need to remember. You also need to remember, not go anywhere. We are content maxing here on Studio 2.
Getting it all in.
Don't go back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. At the center of the ongoing social media trial in California is the accusation that tech companies like Meta and YouTube engineer their apps to be addictive, even as evidence mounts that the algorithms do harm to young users' self-esteem. But often conversations around social media and body image center around young women. But today we want to shift our focus to talk about young men, because there are some very odd approaches to getting surfacing online. Take a look.
Here are two looks maxing techniques that actually work.
Hey guys, you know about bone smashing? It's according to Wolf's Law, right? When you break down a bone, it's gonna grow back stronger.
Mewing is something that you do temporarily to make your jawline pop a little bit more.
Okay, how did I go from this to what I'm looking like right now?
If you want a Dorito body, here's what you need to do.
From unforgiving fitness regimens to intentionally fracturing their own jaws, some men are going to extreme lengths to change their bodies. And while hyper online parlances like looks maxing and bone smashing may be niche, a growing body of research says that body image issues among young men are on the rise. To help us unpack these trends, we're joined by a pair of great guests. Charlie Sosnick is a writer covering male subcultures for GQ and other places. Charlie, welcome to Studio 2.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We also want to welcome in Leon Garber, who is a licensed mental health counselor, writer for Psychology Today, and co-host of the Seize the Moment podcast. Leon, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Hi, Cherry. Hi, Avi. How are you guys?
We're
nice
good.
To see you. So we also want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Our questions of the day: why do you think young men are feeling the pressure to look a certain way? And what do you think looks maxing says about our culture? The number to call to participate is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share the video, but also leave your comments in the live chat.
I want to read this comment from Robert, actually, to start. Robert's a little confused. Robert writes, I think I know this as metrosexual, and I think it's the same thing. This has been around since the earlier 2000s. Examples include young men who shave their armpits. Okay, so let's put that aside for a second, just to use it as a jumping off point, because at the end of the day, Charlie, young men, young women, I think, have always wanted to look really good. They've always wanted to maximize their good looks on some level. What makes looks maxing different than something like what Robert was talking about?
It's a great question. I think when you get down to it, what makes looks maxing is the extremity of its methods and also the systematic approach that looks maxers take. When looks maxers evaluate their appearance, they're doing that in a scientific way. They're measuring their faces, comparing ratios of different facial features to others. And that is sort of a new development. You know, people have always looked in the mirror and said, how do I look? It's a kind of a new thing for people to take a ruler to their face and put it into an Excel spreadsheet and calculate their scores.
And so can we dig in a little bit more to this, Charlie? Because I want you to take us in this looks maxing world. Like, there's a hierarchy, there's language. Can you kind of bring us in and like explain to us how people sort of decide who's maxed and who's not?
Yeah, so the most common way people do that is through something called the PSL score. PSL is an acronym for three mostly male, broadly misogynistic forums from the early 2010s. Pickup artist hate. The S is sort of a rude word for women that I don't think I should say on the radio. Mm-hmm. And the L is lookism. And those three forums are the acronym that we use for PSL. And that's an out of 8 score that people use to compare themselves. So 1 would be the lowest, 8 would be the highest.
And you gestured toward it there, Charlie, but I think it's important to talk about where this culture comes from.
Yeah.
Within the wild world that is online subcultures. Where does this originate from, and what are the, like, I know that you can't say it's not like a political thing, but what are some of the ideological tenets of the world that looks maxing comes out of?
So if we think back.
I'm so sorry. I think we just have to get your line fixed because there's such a delay on it. And I want people to hear this stuff because it's fascinating and important. So let's shift over to Leon now as we get Charlie's line fixed. Leon, you know, you're a licensed mental health counselor. Mm-hmm. As you hear about this notion of sort of an online subculture where men are hyper obsessed with their appearance, striving for some version of perfection, what do you think it's a symptom of in our society?
Yeah, so it's a larger symptom of, one could argue, capitalism, but also the preoccupation with striving, the preoccupation for perfection. So, I mean, there's this famous saying, which I really love. It's pretty much, it goes something like, what's old is new again. And that's a lot of times what we're seeing with something like, with any form of perfectionism, but in this case, with looks maxing. So pretty much is the kind of ascent toward more and more status and to more heights. It's the ascent toward power. It's the ascent toward influence. And so, I mean, unfortunately, what happens with a lot of these people, it becomes a very black and white form of thinking, where you start to think, I either have this or I have nothing, where everything else is sort of devalued, which is, I mean, look, I'm not really qualified to speak on this, but I can just tell you from what I see from patients is that it is a symptom of the broader culture. One could chalk it up to capitalism or whatnot, but the idea is essentially that it's either I succeed or I fail. The world is divided fundamentally between winners and losers. And for a lot of those people, they don't want to be in the latter category.
And so is this about insecurities? Like, what sort of makes a young person, a young man, more susceptible to fall into this culture and to think that they need to do these things to ascend?
Ooh, great question. Okay. So if we're talking just in clinical terms and we're talking, let's say, diagnostic categories, personality structures. So yes, there are certain personalities or certain diagnostic categories that make one a little bit more susceptible than maybe the next person. So we have obsessive compulsive disorder. So these are essentially people that ruminate and fixate over problems, fixate over the negative aspects of their lives, fixate on their flaws. Then we have something called body dysmorphia, where there's a constant and chronic need to compare. So you're frequently comparing your appearance to somebody else's. And then there's also the sense that one is fundamentally and almost irreparably ugly, which is pretty interesting if you think about it, because it's paradoxical, right? Because on the one hand, there's the sense that no matter what I do, nothing is going to change. But on the other hand, looks maxing is obviously this sort of perception that if I keep trying and I try hard enough, things will get better and I'll look better. And again, I'll be able to ascend to greater heights. So again, there's this sort of contradiction that we see in people. On the one hand, it's like nothing I do works, but on the other hand, I have to keep trying and striving. And other personality types that fall into this are something called obsessive compulsive personality disorder. This is pretty much, you can kind of chalk it up to perfectionism, although it's a little bit more than that. And then also narcissistic personality disorder. So with narcissism, it's fundamentally preoccupied and obsessed with status. So anything that's conducive to status, whether it's looks, whether it's, let's say, in some cases and in some cultures, let's say moral superiority, virtue signaling is some symbol of this, or whether it's obviously success oriented. But the idea is it doesn't necessarily matter what the kind of prescription is, whether it's looks or something else, but the fundamental preoccupation is with the climb and status. Mm.
Interesting.
And we are trying to get Charlie Sosnick back on the line. We're going to try to give him a call on the good old fashioned phone, which is funny for an internet show. But speaking of phone calls, 888-477-9499 is our number. What are your questions about looks maxing? What do you think it says about our culture? Why do you think young men feel pressure to look a certain way? Again, the number is 888 877-949-9. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Paul, by the way, brings up something that Leon brought up. Paul says, it's capitalism and patriarchy crashing into the internet and mass narcissism. I wanted to ask about narcissism, actually, Leon, because, like, first of all, it's an old word. It's an old concept.
People use it all the time.
It harkens back, right, to, I think, an ancient Greek myth. So I am a little bit, there is this idea out there that narcissism and self-interest are on the rise. Do you think that's fair? Is it an oversimplification? Or there maybe are, do you think there's genuinely things about our culture that are amplifying narcissism right now?
Ooh, great question. Okay, so unfortunately, it's not one that I don't think any of us can concretely answer, because sure. I'm not really sure what the data would be, especially in the context of the ancient world. But I will tell you this. So if we're looking at just what are called predispositions, either genetic predispositions, personality predispositions, then, I mean, the understanding is you can make a case and you could say probably there wasn't as many outlets for narcissism as there are today. Sure. So meaning that if somebody finds themselves on the message board, if somebody finds themselves, let's say, on Instagram, on Twitter, whatever, X, fundamentally, they'll get the validation that they probably wouldn't have otherwise. You know, back in those days, I mean, you had a community, and fundamentally, that community had a way of limiting you. So meaning if you did have these predispositions toward narcissism, probably your parents, your friends, they would tell you like, hey, dude, first of all, whatever you're looking for, it's probably not going to happen. You need to chill out. You're not being a great person, etc. Whereas when you go into these echo chambers online, probably what it does is exacerbates it. So I would argue that maybe not necessarily a proliferation of, let's say, predispositions towards narcissism, but I would definitely say there's definitely been a more of an probably an actualization of it, because fundamentally, if you're looking for what are they called? If you're looking for pretty much admirers, they're not that hard to find online.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk about online because Grant says these people need to get a life. My advice, get offline, go outside, stop thinking about yourself so much and help other people. And so I know that with social media, right? People get addicted to likes. They get and people who look a certain way get more of those. So how does social media impact young men's, you know, I guess, thoughts and perception of self, and then makes them want to go to extremes to change that image?
Right, right. Great. So great question. And if we're thinking about it as somebody who's already who has a predisposition toward extremes, what the internet does is it pretty much exaggerates it, amplifies it, and even actualizes it. So one can argue is that you don't really need to look far for a reinforcement of your beliefs. So meaning that if people are telling you, hey, here's a surgery that you had, it makes you look great. People do this all the time with weight loss. You know, they will say like, hey, you know, you look so great. Congratulations or whatnot, whether the person even likes that or wants to hear that or not. But you definitely get this on the internet. So what will happen is somebody will come in and they will pretty much say, well, okay, I'm coming into this from a value system of X, right? And that'll be looks maxing and whatever else. And then they'll come in and then people will reinforce every single thing that they're doing. So they don't care about your mental health. They don't care how it's affecting you. They don't care how it's affecting your relationships. As long as your value system is in line with theirs and as long as you're actualizing it, they're going to validate you and tell you that you're doing all of the right things. And it's super hard to get away from that because emotionally we need that validation. And for narcissism, there's a craving for it, almost like you don't exist without it.
So the internet can take something that we're feeling and put like a number behind it. Like this post got X number of likes or X number of comments or X number of views. And I'm curious how you think like the quantification, because that is something that surfaces in looks maxing, the quantification of someone's appeal can change their psychology.
Right. Oh, I love that question so much. So again, if we're coming at it from the framework of black and white thinking, the person pretty much validates themselves again, kind of going higher up in the status hierarchy. So when they're comparing and they're saying, let's say I have this many likes as opposed to, let's say, this other person, that automatically makes them feel good about themselves. Conversely, what happens is obviously if you're comparing yourself to somebody who you don't get as many likes as, now automatically you feel badly about yourself. But the point is to say there's this pretty much this juxtaposition and this contradiction of, on the one hand, I feel incredibly superior because I have all of these followers and all of these likes, while at the same time, I chronically feel like I'm not enough. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of, as you're talking to some of these folks, you're kind of wondering, like, how do you kind of live with that, that sense of tension all day long? Like, you can't really make sense of it because you're chronically comparing yourself and you're always competing, right? And then fundamentally, there is no sense of a core identity. The person pretty much fluctuates between, let's say, good, bad, let's say winner, loser, just based on a particular comparison in that moment.
That's so interesting. And so, Charlie, we're glad to have you back on the show. And so,
welcome back, Charlie.
And where we left off with you is we were talking about the origin story of Looks Maxing.
Absolutely.
And how it sort of, where did it come from? And folks are sort of to the point where it grew to what it's really coming out of a subculture and coming into mainstream culture, especially for very young men.
Yeah. So, to figure that out, we have to go back to the early 2010s. If you remember, that's when we first started to hear the word incel come into popular culture. There was a big concern about what young men are doing on the internet. And a big place that was happening are three forums called PUA Hate. The second one is a pretty rude word for women that starts with an S I don't want to say on the radio. And the third is Lookism. And those places are where sort of incel ideology takes hold. Those are also the earliest places where looks maxing as an idea comes from. And that's rooted in the idea that your life as a man is built around your appearance.
And one of the things you mentioned there was incel, which I think is a shorthand for involuntary celibate. And looks maxing as a term also is a video game reference. And look, you're talking here to millennials, and I think people who are millennials, Gen X, older, would hear those terms and to put it bluntly, think like these are the people on the bottom of the social pyramid. Mm-hmm. Like, how are they driving the conversation about what's cool or what's desirable? These are the folks that were kind of more traditionally shunned. How do you explain that, Charlie?
Well, I think you're right that a lot of these people were socially shunned. Like, the origin of looks maxing comes from the idea that I'm not a very successful man. I struggle to do well socially. I struggle with women. And so that's because of my appearance. And so I have to do everything I can to improve my appearance. I think what happened is, like with many things in the world, COVID happens. Young people especially spend their entire lives on their phone, on social media. A few people from that looks maxing world get very big on TikTok and Reels. And that brings this conversation into the normal sphere. But I still would caution us to think that these people are considered super cool. A lot of the quote-unquote normal kids I've spoken to, they acknowledge this is all a joke. They have no intention of doing any of these more extreme techniques. And so that part can get a little
fuzzy. Can I ask you a follow-up on that? Because one of my big questions as I dug into the research on this was whether these people really have adherence or they just have what are called followers on social media. And the followers could be people that are kind of looking at this as a carnival freak show in a way. They're kind of, they're just looking to gawk. So I'm curious as you dive in, like how genuinely you think the young men online who are invested in this concept, how genuinely they're like absorbing these ideas versus kind of like, these are funny people to look at because they're outrageous.
I think there is a community of people who really do this. They read the guides, they do the techniques, they obsess over their appearance, they calculate their scores, but that's a small, relatively small percentage of young people. There, I would say almost every young person in America or even the world knows what this is. And I think the interesting thing starts to happen when, even if you're watching this guy to make fun of him, do you start to think, oh, I'm laughing at what he's saying, but is there a kernel of truth to it? And spending a lot of time thinking about your appearance in this very extreme way, does that start to kind of infect your own self-esteem and how you think about yourself?
And so, Charlie, I wanted to ask you about the range because Mr. Harold Williams says, are they the same as gym rats? David Began says on YouTube, and Judy Bennett also say gym rats evolved into looks maxers. So I want to talk about this whole soft maxing versus hard maxing and the spectrum, because I understand that it can range from skincare and haircuts to this whole do-it-yourself, you know, facial surgeries, you know, light facial surgeries, light, I should say. But tell us the range and how that sort of plays into the scoring there.
Sure. So for an article I wrote in GQ, I actually had myself evaluated by a few different teenage looks maxers, and they gave me various regimens. So it's mostly split in looks maxing between soft maxing and hard maxing. Soft maxing is your relatively benign techniques, which is where everyone told me to start. They say, lower your body fat, work on your skin, get a better haircut, maybe change your glasses so you have a better fit on your face. Then it starts to get a little more intense. Get minoxidil, which is the same as like what you use for baldness. Put that in your eyebrows to start to thicken up your eyebrows. Do jaw exercises with a chewing toy to start to strengthen those muscles. Then over time, we get into the hard maxing, which is surgeries. There's one called Bimax, which is a double jaw surgery that's very extreme, that's very popular among looks maxers. And some will even do something called bone smashing, which is you take a hammer and tap your face dozens or hundreds of times a day with the goal of stressing the bones and muscles in your face and enlarging them over time to get more of a squared off jaw and defined cheeks.
This might be a stupid question, Charlie, but does any of this work?
I mean, that's a good question and a hard question to answer, right? Like skincare, going to the gym, working on your body fat. I think we sort of accept, right, that that
yeah, a lot of people do
better.
That, yeah.
Exactly. And jaw surgery, people get that, or other cosmetic surgery, people get that without calling themselves a looks maxer under the theory that they will look better. And even the bone smashing thing, they always cite, you guys had it in your montage, this thing called Wolf's Law, which is that stress on bones causes them to strengthen. That's a medical fact. I don't think any doctor in the world, certainly none that I've talked to, would recommend smashing yourself in the face with a hammer. But if you do it, it certainly might change the look of your face if you do it for long enough.
And my question is, and we're coming up on a break in a couple of minutes, but like, who are they doing this for? Like, are they doing this to attract women? Are they doing this to attract other men? Are they doing this for the hierarchy? Like, what's the purpose behind all of this?
So if we go back to lookism, which is sort of the root philosophy of looks maxing, that holds that your appearance determines your life as a man, what your job is, how much money you make, but also how many girls you get. But it's not just about your romantic life or your sex life. It's a deep-rooted theory that the better you look, you walk into a room with other men and you dominate them. The word is you mog them. And that means that you walk into the room and you're the leader simply by looking the best.
One more question before the break, Charlie. How much of this do you think is just to confuse older people? Because I think there's always a tendency for young people to create their own terminology, their own worlds, in some ways just in contradiction in order to violate the taboos of the older world. Do you think that's driving this, or do you think that's maybe really sort of secondary here?
I would say that's secondary. I think people are going to pretty extreme lengths in their personal lives to do this. They're messing with their own bodies and faces. I don't get the sense that that's really done to mess with older people. I think maybe some of your listeners, if your kids are using some of these terms at the dinner table, they might just be doing that to mess with you.
Right.
But the people who really get into it, I think they're doing that for themselves.
That's true.
And the people skew extremely young. I was joining a Discord to research this the other day, and it gives you age options when you join. The age options are under 16, 16 to 17, or 18 and over.
Wow.
That's Charlie Sosnick, a writer covering male subcultures for GQ and other places. We've also been talking with Leon Garber, licensed mental health counselor, writer for Psychology Today, and co-host of the Seize the Moment podcast. Keep your comments and calls coming. We'd love to get to you. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. What do you think looks maxing says about our culture? Why are young men feeling the pressure to look a certain way? Those questions and more on the other side of this break.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This hour, we're talking about looks maxing and young men's fixation on hyper-masculine beauty standards. The trend that originated in fringe and misogynistic online subcultures has found its way into the mainstream with sometimes very real and disturbing consequences. With us this hour are Charlie Sosnick, a writer covering male subcultures for GQ, and Leon Garber, licensed mental health counselor, writer for Psychology Today, and co-host of the Seize the Moment podcast.
And for you, our listeners on the road, at home, or elsewhere, we want to hear from you. Our questions of the day: why do you think young men are feeling the pressure to look a certain way? And what do you think looks maxing says about our culture? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop a comment in the chat. We have a caller on the line. We have Liz from Phillipsburg. Liz, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my comment was that I think that this looks maxing is really just a symptom of a broader issue with our young men who just don't know what it means to be a man. They're having trouble defining that. They're having trouble defining it in their work and what it means to be masculine and what's acceptable. And so they're putting all of that angst into their looks because they're having trouble figuring out how else to define their masculinity.
Yeah, that's a great comment from Liz from Phillipsburg.
I got to hear Leon's thoughts on that. Leon Garber. So I think in some ways the question here is, what the heck's going on with young men? Obviously, you work with lots of patients, and I'm just curious if you think Liz's comments and call there reflect something that you're seeing.
Right. Okay. I love that comment so much. So, but unfortunately, it's actually the opposite of what we're seeing. So one can make the case and say that they're, let's say, not defining it in a healthy way or in a way that sort of makes sense with what the world is or what the world has to offer. But fundamentally, they actually are defining. So they're defining masculinity in this really hyper-aggressive, dominant way, where the only way that they could feel good about themselves is essentially if they're kind of the belle of the ball, essentially. So where they're kind of the center of attention, where every single thing that sort of the world kind of, or everything that the world has to offer, it's solely for them or for them and their kind of tribe of which they often have to be the leaders of. So it's not so much of, let's say, a void in values. It's actually more of a crisis in values. So the main issue is that they have these values that, again, they go into these echo chambers and they're chronically reinforced. And so fundamentally, you have a bunch of people, it's this sort of mentality of being the alpha male. And you have a bunch of people who are kind of sort of geared toward you, you know, and they're making you feel like you're incredibly special and rules don't apply to you and you could do whatever you want and all because you earned it. Right? You've climbed this ladder to success and that's all you're doing. And you're, again, this special person. So again, one would argue that there needs to be, I would argue, a necessarily reassessment of values as a point to kind of considering it as a void of values. Although, to Liz's point, I would argue that there is a void of values in some sense, in the sense of the values being completely off the charts.
Like, but maybe, really, I think maybe to Liz's point, and obviously she's not with us anymore, but that young men had become unmoored in some way to the point where this type of value system becomes appealing it's like what might be the explanation for that, and I'll just let you maybe meditate on that for a second, Leon.
So you're saying the explanation for pretty much our value systems or the lack thereof, like why did they turn to online circles? Would that be it?
Exactly. Like what would be appealing about this particular value system right now for young men? And maybe the answer is it's always been appealing on some level. This is just a different sort of flavor of it, right? Or maybe there is something that's happening with young men in our society that would kind of funnel them toward this value system.
Right. Great. Right. So, and I think the deeper question is going to be what's made perfectionism appealing in general, right? So you have, let's say we have something called moral perfectionism, which is not so prominent, even though we have something called virtue signaling. You also have success oriented perfectionism. So pretty much respectively, what they mean is that the moral perfectionist is obsessed about being a good person, appearing like a good person. Some of them go even deeper and need to always be a good person. Then you have success oriented perfectionism, where the fundamental sense of self is based on status. It's pretty much based on wealth. It's based on notoriety, fame, et cetera, right? So fundamentally, the question is going to be, why do people turn to perfectionism? And usually it's a multitude of issues. So you have something like trauma a lot of times. You have a history of bullying. You have a history of exclusion, kind of an innate need to some extent, let's say not only to fit in, but one could argue for admiration. And then you take that and you couple that with bullying. And what ends up happening is a person ends up unfortunately needing to feel superior. And so there's a sense of vengeance, right? We see this like in Village in Orange, origin stories, right? We see this like in The Joker. Yeah, The Joker was such a great example of that, right? Where he was like, I'm going to kind of show the world that I'm above all of it. So you have that. And then on top of that, you also have personality structures. So you'll have people who are more or less pretty sensitive. And let's say they're predisposed to narcissistic personalities. Yeah. And so fundamentally, what they will do is if you couple all of these things together, you will have this sort of, let's say, hodgepodge or this melting pot. Unfortunately, that ends up turning into this. And again, it becomes status obsession. But yes, it is a form of perfectionism.
Yeah. And I want to get your thoughts on this, Charlie, because, you know, this value system with looks maxing is sort of replacing the way men typically used to look at themselves as the provider in the household, as the breadwinner. And we've seen like women have changed. And so do you see this as an answer to maybe some of the changing space that women have seen happen over the past few decades and maybe men finding their a new space, a new hierarchy amongst themselves and the way they view the world? I'd love to get your thoughts on what you've seen in some of these places, these chat rooms on Discord and other places, Charlie.
Well, the gender aspect is huge. A major component of looks maxing as an ideology, as a way of thinking, is the belief that women have it easier in life, that women get things bought for them, have an easier time at work, and that you as a man are going to struggle. If you improve your looks under this philosophy, you can sort of chip away at that disparity and have an easier life, have more success at work, make more money, be more popular.
So the looks are the key to an easier life. By the way, I want to ask quickly about politics because Margaret says NPR coverage of this topic emphasized the predominance of the Tate brothers and Nick Fuentes as leaders. The purpose is to make other men feel bad about themselves. That's Margaret's comment. And Jan is wondering if this trend affects Black and Asian men as much as white men. And so I wanted to sort of talk about the politics factor, the race factor, some of the other things, Charlie, that sort of go into this hierarchy. How does that wrap in? Does it matter? Do people who are into looks maxing tend to only be white men who have a particular political persuasion, or is it more diverse?
I would say it is not diverse. If you can imagine your sort of nastiest stereotype of an internet chat room, that's what these look like, and they are often pretty explicitly racist, I would say, across the board. Of course, you get nicer people, less nice people, whatever, but I'd be fairly comfortable saying that there is quite a lot of offensive and racist content being shared all the time. And the sort of rigid hierarchy of looks maxing tends to prioritize white skin, blue eyes, stereotypically European features, let's say. Politically, I think that is a very difficult thing to answer because we tend to want to make these blanket associations about it. But first of all, most of these people are teenagers who can't even vote and have had a very short political life. And many of the most famous looks maxers specifically refuse to deal in politics. So Clavicular, who I would say is the most famous looks maxer in the world right now, he is often pressed about politics in interviews, and he says he doesn't care about politics. All he cares about is looking better, and worrying about politics, talking about politics, doesn't help him. He famously said he would vote for Gavin Newsom over J.D. Vance just because he thinks Gavin Newsom is more handsome.
Yeah, and
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I want to read in a couple more comments here. First of all, Christopher Clayton just says too extreme. I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. But this comment from LookaBear88 on YouTube was interesting. They say, anyone else feel like we are failing kids as a society? And that leads me to a question for you, Leon. There has to be parents listening right now thinking, I know my young people in my life are interested in this, or they talk about it. I'm worried. What could I do to buoy their self-esteem so that this type of thing does not become attractive to them? That's difficult to do, I think, but are there ways that you would advise parents, Leon, to try to reach young people who feel like their sons or daughters might be susceptible to this type of ideology?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll tell them or ask them to gently challenge their child's perspectives or perceptions or value systems. So a lot of times with looks maxing, as Charlie alluded to, I mean, there's a sort of hierarchy, and then there's a sense of like, you know, where this is all going, right? So if I'm extremely good looking, jobs will come easy to me, friends will come easy to me, women will obviously come easy to me, et cetera. So you can obviously help your child challenge that belief, because obviously, unfortunately or fortunately, looks are not everything, right? So they're not going to get you all of these rewards in life. So one could say, okay, kind of sit them down, ask them why they believe what they do. Why is this? First of all, why is this even important? But second of all, why do you think any of this will happen to you just based on, let's say, being better looking? And then the second thing I would argue is that you would have to also kind of talk to them about things that actually are important to them in the day to day. So what's super interesting, I think, for all of us is that like most of us don't actually think about our looks, right? Most of us kind of like hang out with our friends. We hang out at work. We go to like, you know, talk to our colleagues or whatnot. Like me as a therapist, I talk to my patients, right? So most of my day to day, my values are in my actions. And I don't necessarily think about it in terms of like, how do I look to this person? So I would ask them to kind of remind also their kids that the things that they value in the day to day are not their looks. They don't even think about them, right? So all of the things that they've already achieved up until that point, right? Their grades in school, perhaps, their friendships, maybe relationships, romantic relationships that they've already had, that's already been based in what's good enough about them, what people already like. So just because, let's say, there are these other values, A, doesn't mean that their life is going to get better, or maybe not even better, right? But then on top of that, they already have a lot of the things that they want based on who they are in this moment.
Yeah. And, you know, Charlie, I wonder if have you talked to people who sort of were looks maxers and sort of got off that highway, took an off ramp, realized that they were stuck in this online culture, and by sort of disconnecting, you know, touching some grass, were able to sort of reconnect? Or do you see folks just kind of stuck in this world?
I haven't talked to too many ex-looks maxers, or at least people who would describe themselves that way. But the clue, I think, is just how young almost everyone is.
Yeah.
I struggle to find a true looks maxer who's even in their mid-20s. I don't think I've ever talked to one who's over 24. And so that, to me, gives me some small sense of hope that people sort of grow out of this. There's a possibility that this is just everyone remembers what it was like to be a teenager. You're really concerned about how you look. You're really concerned about how you fit in.
And you're searching for yourself. And I think there's so much searching for self that I feel in this world. And then what I hear you kind of getting to, Charlie, is that you get a little older and maybe you find yourself and you don't need
all of that.
Yeah. The scaffolding, I suppose. I don't know. Anything else you wanted to add, Charlie, there?
The other thing I do think about is the challenge of this being a specifically male thing. So I'm 28 years old. When I was in middle school, early high school, there societally was a big response to body image issues in girls.
Yep.
There was we were having classes in school about how, you know, Victoria's Secret models, they look very rare. Or, you know, the importance of having healthy boundaries and eating disorder lessons in school. I think for years we didn't really think that boys needed this type of education. And I think that's why looks maxing as a whole is catching us so off guard.
Mm. Yeah. And that's why I wonder, Leon, in my mind, because most young people come online, they're early teens. You know, you start worrying, like actually caring the way you look. You want to get your hair cut. You want to, you know, maybe lose some of that baby fat or whatever. So just sort of, if you're a parent and you have young people in your life, how do you know it's not just that? Is something more? Is there are there clues that you should be looking for? Because you don't want to stop somebody from like self-care at the same time.
Yeah.
You don't want them to go into the area that this maxing area.
Okay, I love that question. So there are two things here that are going to apply from the DSM, the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Issues or Disorders. And then so the two things that we look for are pretty much, does it cause distress? And number two is, does it impair the quality of your life in taking care of yourself, in, let's say, the way you see yourself, obviously, too, in your relationships, and then your ability to work, and if you're a child, obviously, go to school. So if the case is yes for either, it could either be one of the two, but if the case is yes for obviously both of them, then the answer is that there's a major issue here. So the two two things that we tend to look for are A, self-esteem, and then also B, fixation. So if the child is essentially fixated on their looks, like meaning that they kind of ruminate about it, they talk about it a lot, they feel like they can't feel good about themselves without a particular procedure, or let's say without, just doesn't necessarily even have to be cosmetic. It could be without, I don't know, changing their body type in yeah. some meaningful way. Then fundamentally, we would argue that we're on that borderline of mental illness. Mm.
Wow. Thank you so much for that comment and everything this hour. Leon Garber, licensed mental health counselor, writer for Psychology Today, and co-host of the Seize the Moment podcast. Appreciate your time, Leon.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Charlie Sosnick, a writer covering male subcultures for GQ. Great reporting on this topic, by yes. the way, and great insights yeah. and making it kind of understandable for the rest of us. Not an easy thing to do. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, and today is DJ of the Day, so it is now time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
Hey, 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 hey. Macho, macho man.
Macho man, yeah.
I've got to be a macho man.
And that is Macho Man. You probably know it best as the 1978 Village People disco hit. But because our DJ of the day, Matthew B., didn't specify, we're listening to the version that came out that year from The Muppet Show.
So there you go. I was wondering. I was like, this doesn't sound like the Village People. Okay. Well, we love The Muppets. I love The Muppets. So anything by The Muppets is good for me. Thank you, Matthew B., for being our DJ of the day. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory, who did this to us.
Uh-huh.
Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY Philadelphia. I am Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us. Macho Man.